I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, how the CIA manipulates the media and Hollywood. My guest from Santa Ana, California, is Nicholas Hsu. Nicholas is an award-winning investigative journalist whose articles have resulted in the release from prison of wrongly convicted people. He is currently the managing editor of OC Weekly, an alternative news publication in Southern California. In the past, he has written for LA Weekly, the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and other publications. Nick is the author of the bestseller, Kill the Messenger, about the CIA's cocaine operations and the courageous investigative reporting of Gary Webb. The book was made into a major movie featuring Jeremy Renner. His most recent publication is Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, which has received excellent reviews by Peter Dale Scott, whistleblower John Curacao, and Oliver Stone, among others. His websites are focusfeatures.com and ocweekly.com. Nice to have you with us today, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Before we look at more contemporary issues where the CIA, the Pentagon, and our national intelligence has manipulated and infiltrated American media, and even foreign media for that matter, I'd like to frame this in a larger context. We are led to believe that we are a nation that prides itself in free press. In the past, that was always understood to mean that the media, including newspapers, television, and the press, had the legal right to report the news or print and state commentaries without being controlled by any arm or branch of government. Of course, that also precludes that a media firm has the right to collude with the government as well. But then any media outlet that does so should never define or describe itself as a free press. We have also assumed for years that public radio and television was more representative of free press because of public funding, although now we know, without question, it is equally bought off by commercial interest. I think a good example would be the Koch brothers giving PBS millions of dollars in donations, but then the network never aired a special program that was to reveal unsavory things about the Kochs. With respect to the CIA and national intelligence involvement of the media, I remember Operation Mockingbird. That was way back in the 1950s, and that was launched by Alan Dulles and Cord Meyer, by the way, whose ex-wife happened to be JFK's lover. We had her son on this program talking about that. And this was an operation to influence the media by recruiting journalists to assist in presenting the CIA's world and national views. So our federal spy agencies have been at this for a long time. In fact, we have studied the text from the church committees where it was revealed that many media in the United States and around the world were infiltrated with CIA people posing as journalists, but they were, in fact, capable of journalists, but they were also sharing information and insights with the CIA. Even Pacifica has banned certain programs, including the subject of vaccines on KPFA in Berkeley, where Bonnie Faulkner, on two occasions, had her program censored, one with me and one with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, at a time when it was necessary to discuss the issues of the safety and efficacy of vaccines and of parents' right to choose which vaccines versus being mandated by law. And we had information on which legislators had received different amounts of money and therefore, in my personal opinion, were completely compromised, including the lead sponsor of the bill. We had the amounts of money, both Democrat and Republicans, and we had the bad science that they had used to get this passed. And yet when I came forward in a special to present quality, independent science, we were not allowed on. Now, I'm not suggesting that it had anything to do with the CIA. I am suggesting that for a foundation to pride itself and promote itself and raise funds based upon its, we are the Freedom of Speech Network, well, this is simply not true, irrespective of the underlying cause. Also, I'm going to ask you at some point to address how many social issue organizations, protest organizations, have been infiltrated by the CIA, and therefore the media does not represent what they're about or their leaders in any true and honest and objective way because of the influence of these intelligence agencies. So if you could take us in this journey, the forum is yours.
Well, the book starts off with what you referred to as Project Mockingbird, which is basically another name for the Mighty Wurlitzer, which is what Frank Wisner of the CIA called the CIA's mandate to go out and more or less take over as much of the apparatus of American academia and journalism and culture as possible. And so this has been a topic that's been pretty much well reported, you know, and the CIA itself has, of course, admitted to all of this. It was first exposed to a wide audience in 1977 by Carl Bernstein, not writing for the Washington Post, where he was employed full-time, notably, but for Rolling Stone magazine. And he named names. He wrote a very lengthy article based on a lot of information that came out during the Watergate era of all the different reporters and editors of different very prominent news outlets, as well as TV and radio networks that were working directly on the payroll of the CIA. And the CIA did this, of course, to try to directly control what the American public was reading and hearing on the radio and seeing on television. And this reached, you know, a very fever pitch, I would say, during the Vietnam era. Among the people that I interviewed for this book, in particular, was Frank Snepp, who, if you're familiar with him, he was in charge of briefing the press in Saigon for several years, starting in 1969, all the way up until the very end of the war. And he talked quite candidly with me about how the CIA used him to mislead the public by leaking information to reporters that were either working directly for the CIA on their payroll in some cases, or just friendly to the agency, trusted assets that could be relied upon to put out the stories that the CIA wanted out there. So,
could you go into more depth on that?
Yeah, so one really interesting story he told me was about how, in order to try to continue to receive the funding from Congress that was necessary to wage the war, the CIA would kind of come up with statistics that were what he called sort of half-truths, which, for example, involved numbers of North Vietnamese infiltrators along the border with Cambodia that were coming in every year. They would give this information to reporters so that they would put it out there in the media and that the you know, lawmakers would read that 60,000 NVA troops per month were crossing into South Vietnam, and therefore we needed more troops to come to the combat zone and fight. But what they weren't releasing to the reporters and what the American public and lawmakers weren't being told was that an equal number of NVA troops were being reported to be killed through airstrikes and so forth along the border. So all the infiltration that was happening was being sort of countered by a very bloody campaign of bombing. And so this was just basically a game that was being played to try to justify prolonging a war that was unwinnable.
But the whole reason we got into that war was because of a series of lies. Could you take us through the Gulf of Tonkin fiasco? All lies, as it turns out.
Right, exactly. So this is a very famous incident. Of course, it involved a couple of naval vessels that were supposedly attacked in a very murky encounter with North Vietnamese torpedo boats. And there's no evidence that any attack actually occurred, but there were some conflicting reports that were put out there initially. A captain of one of the ships reported being fired upon, for example, and by the time, you know, they realized that their reports were erroneous, the story had already been forwarded to the White House, to the Johnson administration, and so he seized upon this as sort of a pretext for escalating our involvement in Vietnam. We were just waiting for an excuse to to have a showdown over there. And the CIA wasn't so much directly involved with that particular pretext, but the CIA had been on the ground and in Vietnam for decades by that point. And they were, of course, deeply involved with creating the type of instability that led to this conflict in the first place. And I think the most kind of dark aspect of the CIA's involvement in Vietnam, of course, was Operation Phoenix. And, you know, this was a really terrible campaign of torture and interrogation that the press knew about. That's the thing that's so kind of shameful about it, is that this is something that most Americans are not really necessarily familiar with, but it was an open secret that we were torturing people. And these interrogation centers were set up by the CIA, and there was involvement with academics, for example, that helped like come up with interrogation programs. And this all has echoes much more recently in the CIA's kind of ongoing involvement with torture, with its continuing involvement. But this was like probably one of the biggest cover-ups of the Vietnam War, successful cover-ups, was the level to which innocent people were caught up in a terrible torture program that just indiscriminately targeted people based on faulty intelligence, and you know, thousands of people were killed.
Also, could you please discuss what was covered up by the mainstream media? Was Henry Kissinger's and Richard Nixon's secret bombing campaign in Cambodia, and also how that impacted the local person who had nothing to do with the war, and yet the media did not hold them accountable. And to this day, no one has paid a price for the injustice of that conflict.
Right. I mean, so that was, the CIA, of course, was waging a completely illegal war in Laos, and a secret war that was secret, of course, not to anybody there. Everybody knew about it. But it was very successfully shielded from the American public. And so, you know, the CIA, by the time Vietnam came around, had already done this very successfully in several other cases. The first one was in Iran, where it overthrew a democratically elected government, and then in Guatemala, where it did the same thing, both with terrible results, ultimately, for both the people there that were affected by it, but also for just in general world stability. But the problem was that the CIA was so good at it. But that ran into a bit of a problem in Southeast Asia. The CIA just wasn't able to sort of do what it wanted to do as efficiently or as quietly as it wanted to anymore. And, of course, that's when the Pentagon got involved. And that's when more bombs were dropped on any, you know, location that had ever been bombed before, in Laos and then in Cambodia, where, you know, countless thousands of people were killed by airstrikes that had nothing to do with any war whatsoever, and were just innocent victims of a machine that was out of control.
One of the early incidences of CIA manipulation of news that I didn't know about was Project Mogul and the so-called crashed UFO report in Roswell, New Mexico. Now, I know there are numerous different interpretations of this, and some are far out, but how it relates to the Cold War and our intelligence operations against Russia, I found interesting. So please share that story with us.
Right. So it wasn't until, I believe, the late 1990s, I could be incorrect on the exact time frame, but not that long ago, when the CIA finally started declassifying information that it had regarding extraterrestrial, you know, events and eyewitness accounts and so forth. And so this led to sort of a broader internal review by the CIA of its involvement in UFO phenomena, for example. And so one of the reports, and history reports basically, that the CIA put out was about something called Project Mogul. And I managed to get a hold of that report. And it talks about the fact that when this crash happened in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, within days of the CIA actually being codified into law, the National Security Act passing and so forth, there was an initial report that was put out claiming that a flying saucer had crashed, and this became the famous Roswell incident, which immediately the story was put out by the Air Force that this was actually a weather balloon. And no one, of course, ever believed that in this incident, and the perceived cover-up fueled a lot of interest in UFOs. But apparently what this balloon that crashed was involved with was a classified program predating the CIA. It was just right before, again, like I said, that it was created, but where the U.S. government was using high-altitude balloons to try to sense nuclear weapons explosions that were coming from Russia, nuclear tests. And so it was a very sort of early-stage satellite-type technology that they were trying to develop, and this crash spelled the end for it, but it sort of inadvertently led to this huge skyrocketing interest in UFOs.
I don't want to go too much into the biological story or biographical story of Gary Webb. I knew him. He was a friend. But he also, in my opinion, was a true investigative journalist. He was from California, and he uncovered the chain of cocaine smuggling related to the Iran-Contra scandal into Los Angeles' African-American communities. And we've had Robert Perry and the late Michael Rupert on many times discussing the details of this. But the other story is the CIA's operations and interactions with the media when Webb was exposing all of this, and of course could never figure out how two, not just one, .38 caliber gunshots to the head could be ruled a suicide. Nevertheless, take your time on this one, because this deserves attention. Gary was, we're told, committed suicide. I don't know if he did or not. I do know that the major media's attacks against him were reprehensible. And that he called me and he said, "Gary, do you know why all this is going on?" And I said, "My only guess would be that you told a truth, and that truth may spark interest by other reporters. So as long as they can destroy you, then they destroy the credibility of your story. You're not going to be cited. You won't be a reference." And that was unfortunate. So take us through this, since you're very familiar with this.
Right. Well, so I got my start in national security reporting, for lack of a better term, but also covering the war on drugs by virtue of the fact that I was one of the few reporters to actually follow up on Gary Webb's investigative work that he did in Dark Alliance in 1996, and found, you know, very interesting connections between some of the characters that were involved in this drug smuggling ring and the CIA. I mean, the initial counterattack against Webb focused much on Freeway Ricky Ross and some of the other Nicaraguans who were supplying him, and the CIA anonymously, you know, through off-the-record quotes, told all the major newspapers that, you know, were in a place to either advance Webb's work or to attack it, that, oh, you know, we didn't have anything to do with these individuals, we don't know who they are. And I actually found, you know, I was very quickly on the phone with former CIA officials that knew people that were involved in that drug ring, and it was clear that, you know, that there was more to this story, and that the media needed to actually really start digging in objectively to what Webb had uncovered and try to demand some answers. But that's exactly the opposite of what happened, unfortunately. And so I had a sort of a front row seat to the process of Webb's story being attacked by all the major media in this country, and then his personal reputation on top of that being attacked as well, and how he was driven out of journalism. And it was, you know, very frustrating to me, and I stayed in contact with Webb. I knew him very well, just, you know, by virtue of helping him with his book, for example, and doing research and filing Freedom of Information Act requests. And, you know, unfortunately, I have to say that, you know, as I ultimately came to the conclusion after researching not just his life, but also the circumstances of his death for the biography I wrote about Gary, Kill the Messenger, you know, very clear to anybody that knew Webb or is familiar with, you know, the circumstances of his death, the timing of it. For example, the day he had to move back into his mother's house after being unable to afford paying a mortgage and selling his house and going through a difficult divorce and writing suicide letters and, you know, arranging for his body to be cremated. I could go on and on, but basically the gist of it is that Gary, you know, grappled, I think. I even interviewed a woman that was on the phone with him when he was saying he was going to commit suicide shortly before he did it. And he, I think, didn't want to go through with something that he was determined to do. He was clinically depressed, But, you know, it's difficult to make a decision that you know is going to hurt people that you love, his family. And he sat there with the gun in his hand, apparently, for quite a while and bruised, you know, and the trigger finger just by virtue of holding onto it so tight. And he pulled the trigger, which was of a gun that had a hair trigger, apparently. And the bullet just grazed his head. And he pulled the trigger again and nicked an artery. But if anybody had actually heard the gunshot, they would have been able to save his life, apparently. He bled to death very slowly. So this is a very tragic end to a courageous person that I had a lot of personal respect for. And I feel that it's sad to a certain extent that people are under the impression that the CIA is somehow responsible for his death, rather than the destruction of his reputation and personal career at the hands of fellow reporters that should have known better. But there's really no evidence for anything other than the suicide, first of all. And it just doesn't make sense for the CIA to be involved in an assassination 10 years after his, you know, life had already been destroyed on the very occasion in which he quite clearly was planning on taking his own life anyway.
What can you tell us about the CIA destroying Gary Webb's reputation with their sources inside the media?
Well, so that's a different story, and that's something that I tackled with Kill the Messenger, and I revisit that in Spook. The CIA, after Gary died, shortly before Kill the Messenger came out in theaters in late 2014, through a FOIA lawsuit, ended up having to release a report called Managing a Nightmare. And it was all about how the CIA tried to respond to the charges that Webb made and how it worked with reporters that were already apparently quite eager to debunk Gary's work. Because you have to understand, and as I'm sure Bob Perry has probably already explained on your show before, I mean, Gary wasn't the first reporter to dig into the question of the CIA's involvement with contra-era drug smuggling, for example. And so there were a lot of reporters that read Webb's story and had been completely, you know, scooped on it and were hoping for the easy way out by just debunking it. And so, unprecedentedly, the CIA almost never, in fact, never, and they say this quite clearly in their own internal report, they never confirm or deny their relationship with individuals. That's just a ground rule for the CIA when it comes to, on an official level at least, and on the record level when it comes to dealing with the press. But they broke that rule for apparently the very first time, specifically in order to deny any connection to the individuals that Gary Webb wrote about. So that was pretty interesting. And that kind of gave the on-the-record open kind of cover for these major newspapers to say it's official, the CIA had nothing to do with this. But they were also being guided off the record by CIA sources that were eager to try to diminish their culpability in something that, ironically, the CIA itself, after Webb's story had already been attacked and Webb had already left journalism, the CIA admitted that they had a very much broader involvement with contra-drug smuggling than Webb's story had actually implied, or any of these previous reports that Bob Perry and other reporters had worked on in the 1980s had ever suggested. And this report that the CIA put out via its inspector general was completely ignored by the same papers that had attacked Gary.
Do we know which is no surprise. At the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post was complicit?
Basically the orders kind of came down from the top editors, especially at the LA Times. You have to understand there was a particular shame internally in the LA Times that they had been scooped on who had been supplying Freeway Ricky Ross with all of his cheap crack cocaine. I mean, they had elevated Freeway Rick to the status of the city's crack kingpin in a 1994 profile that a journalist named Jesse Katz had written. And so after Gary's story came along exposing, well, this is who was giving Freeway Rick all this cheap coke, Jesse Katz was flown from Texas, where he was working on a feature story, back to L.A., and they all sat down in a meeting, you know, something like 15 or 20 reporters, and they decided, here's how we're going to, you know, effectively rewrite history. And so Katz was given the job of writing yet another story about Freeway Rick, but this time, you know, denying that he was that important of a drug dealer after all, which is just insane. But, you know, they had 20 people working on this attack on Webb, so there were a lot of names on there. And not everybody, for example, at the different papers that attacked Webb really agreed with what was happening. So, for example, the Washington Post, they had Walter Pincus was sort of the top best connected national security reporter that was involved in attacking Webb. And he, as it turned out, had actually worked for the CIA as a student, spying on student groups in his youth, and had over the years built up quite a close relationship with the CIA at the Washington Post, which of course is a paper that historically and continues to this day to have the tightest relationship with that agency. And he sort of led the attack. But there was a reporter named Douglas Farah on the ground in Central America who was investigating this and actually coming up with information that backed up what Webb was saying. But of course, he wasn't as well connected as Walter Pincus. So the attacks went forward undeterred.
One of the early incidences that we should have paid attention to as a society when it began to break out, and we didn't, was how the media sold us the war in Iraq. And at that time, I did a series of programs where we were able to confirm that the operative who was supposed to have all this wonderful information that Judith Miller at the New York Times was using to bang the drums for war was actually not credible at all, was not able to pass a polygraph test. And so we talked about the likely outcome if we invaded the country, and it didn't matter. We were one small voice. But today, when we look back, we can now see with some certainty, based upon interviews with people like Ray McGovern and others, that this was a manufactured war. Could you tell us your perspective on this and what you have found out and what we can learn from this and why the media should not just automatically be treated with respect that it has not earned, especially when it's been wrong and so few that were wrong have come forward and say, we were wrong on this. Here's how we got it wrong, and here's who we trusted, so that at least we're able to have some better view of this. Otherwise, we're going to do the same thing over and over and over again. We keep doing it with Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Honduras, same people, same cast of characters, and we end up no closer to the truth than any of them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what happened to Gary Webb is, like, on a small scale, the exact same process that unfolded in a much more dangerous way with the build-up to the war in Iraq, where you just had a script that was being put out effectively by the national security state in a general sense, that Iraq was a menace and, you know, needed to be put in its place. And so stories just started getting effectively shopped around by anonymous intelligence sources that would pass them to sort of conservative op-ed columnists at the Washington Post and at the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, the sort of leading opinion-making columnists. And so they would write these stories that would basically have this, what purported to be like exclusive raw data intelligence on all these things that Saddam Hussein was up to. And then the rest of the media, of course, would just sort of pick up on that and disseminate the story. And so what was kind of interesting about what happened with the WMD scandal is that it didn't really originate with the CIA. I mean, some of the initial wildly off-base intelligence that was being circulated was CIA material, but it wasn't the CIA that was leaking it. The CIA was doing this for the Bush administration, and it was Dick Cheney's office, generally speaking, who was passing this to his cohorts in the National Security Council, who then passed it to these op-ed columnists, and sort of it went that way. And it was interesting to see how the CIA at some point had to start trying to figure out how to use its own network of relationships to try to get differing reporting out there, because it realized, oh my God, we're playing this game all too, you know, close to people that have a political agenda that we didn't quite understand. So in other words, the CIA wasn't really necessarily trying to push this intelligence out there, but by the time it tried to get different data out there in the public, it was basically too little too late, and they got kind of burned by a game that they sort of started, if you will. But the key difference between, of course, what happened with the way Gary Webb's story was attacked and the way that script was followed and the way the WMD stories were put out there is that, you know, only Gary Webb suffered any consequence whatsoever for the scandal that unfolded over his reporting. None of the editors or reporters that worked on that story with him ever, you know, have suffered any consequences. And, of course, none of the papers that attacked him based on faulty information and failed to follow up on the material that showed that Gary was right all along, none of those papers or people suffered any consequences. And then they went on to play this game with the WMD information that led to this disastrous war, and the consequences of that are just impossible to calculate. We're still paying the price for this.
Between $3 to $5 trillion for Afghanistan and Iraq, according to the Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, that does not include 4 million internally displaced people, that does not include anywhere between 900,000 to 1.5 million dead Iraqis, that does not include the utilities in many areas of Iraq only being on 1 hour a day, and hospitals without medicines, and the depleted uranium used in the munitions that are now making it one of the most toxic places on Earth, with zero being done by our government to clean it up. So the human suffering of the people in Iraq and the entire area, the same is true with Libya. What role did the CIA play in this Libyan fiasco and its subsequent problems with Benghazi and the attacks? What do you have for us on that, please?
I mean, my book doesn't really deal so much with the chaos that sort of unfolded as a result of our intervention in Iraq. It's really focused more on the narrative of how the CIA was involved with manipulating the media into publishing information that led to this conflict. And then, for example, how the Pentagon, once they took over the military aspect of our involvement there, how they manipulated the press. And so I write quite a bit about how, example, money was funneled to the Baghdad Press Club to put out stories written by Iraqi journalists that tried to paint the best picture on the military developments during the Iraq War. And ultimately this was stopped because it was just such an embarrassment that it was impossible to come up with like any positive coverage, no matter how hard you tried to spin it. And also, with the Pentagon's circus that it's been running in Guantanamo Bay, I have a whole chapter of information about how the Pentagon has been able to sell Guantanamo Bay to the public and how it's been able to cover up torture and, in some cases, apparently murder of detainees.
Nick, tell us this story, please.
So the story really kind of picks up in 2006 when a young, actually older than the typical age of the guards at Guantanamo Bay, who are typically in their 20s, there was a guard who was in his mid-30s and was a highly decorated soldier at that point named Joseph Hickman, and he was basically the commanding officer and the commanding sergeant-at-arms in charge of the guard tower over Camp Delta, where all the detainees were being held that were regarded as troublesome inmates. And so he saw three inmates at three different times being taken out of the camp, driven towards an area of the base where he knew there was actually a building that was not on any map, wasn't accounted for. It certainly wasn't anything that anybody was supposed to know about, including him. And then over the course of the next couple of hours, he watched as this truck brought three bodies back, and apparently the official story that was put out was that these detainees who had rags stuffed in their throats had committed suicide in an act of asymmetrical warfare. And he never believed that for a minute because it just didn't fit the facts. And he tried to get answers for it. And after he left the military, he continued to dig into this and worked with reporters and my book really goes to quite great lengths to try to track down the actual independent reporters that are trying to get these stories out, and one of them is Jason Leopold, who's currently with Vice News. And so the two of them basically together more or less were able to generate Freedom of Information Act requests that exposed what actually happened at that base and how the military has effectively covered it up. But of course, the media wouldn't really pick up on this story. You have to really dig deeply and read very carefully to even find out anything about this. So big goal of my book is to try to shine a light on some of these stories where you do have courageous reporters that are actually trying to get the story out there. But of course, these stories are they're largely ignored by the mainstream press. And so Hickman, to his credit, you know, wouldn't let that happen. But one thing that was interesting in interviewing him was that this person was, you know, a front participant in the Circus Act that the Pentagon was carrying out. So it was effectively his job whenever reporters came down to Guantanamo Bay to kind of guide them along and kind of make sure that they didn't ask too many questions and that nobody actually divulged anything. And so the description that he gave me of how this worked was just amazing. He said that they were terrified when Ted Koppel came to Guantanamo Bay because they expected that this reporter, being as prominent as he was going to really make their lives difficult and kind of blow open what was happening. But as it turned out, Ted Koppel really didn't ask any tough questions at all. And by and large, that's what the press did. They would just get flown down there, and then they would take some shots in front of the barbed wire and talk about, you know, how little they knew about what was happening, and then they'd pack up and leave.
What else can you tell us about Guantanamo that we don't know?
Well, there was another strange aspect to the deaths that occurred there, which was that all of these three people that supposedly committed suicide tested positive for mefloquine. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's an anti-malarial drug. And the strange thing about that is that there isn't any malaria in Cuba, and none of the soldiers stationed at Guantanamo Bay had been given injections of mefloquine because there was no point to it. But one of the side effects of mefloquine is like extreme anxiety, paranoia, and that kind of thing. And the interesting work that Jason Leopold of Vice dug into, working with Hickman, involved trying to find out exactly why prisoners were being administered this drug and whether, in fact, it's possible that it was being used in interrogations.
Let's take a step further back. The media, and especially CNN, have been working from the same notes for a long time, manipulating the, for example, the Iranian presence of Mujahideen stories. The CIA was instrumental in supplying guns to the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden. But the consequences of that action, they don't report on. The same today, when the annex, the CIA annex in Libya, we're told that guns were being shipped from Libya into Syria vis-a-vis Turkey and getting in the hands of al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and other organizations. And yet it's not the media telling us that. It's individual investigative journalists. We find out from Seymour Hersh that it wasn't Assad that was using the chemical weapons. It was the terrorist groups, and they explain how that happened. So the media has let us down when it comes to telling us the truth about Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, even the efforts to undermine the government, irrespective of how corrupt it was, in Ukraine, and also Hillary Clinton's involvement in the coup in Honduras. And yet the people still believe the media, even if we don't get the truth on any of this. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try to focus to the extent that I can on trying to find reporters, including Seymour Hersh, who I interviewed, including Jason Leopold, Jonathan Landay. There's a handful of others that James Risen, for example, at the New York Times, who broke two of the biggest stories of the war on terror involving the NSA illegal wiretapping scandal and another story of our effort to try to destabilize the Iranian nuclear program, which totally backfired. And in both of those huge stories that he wrote, the New York Times just sat on them and refused to publish them after being told not to by the CIA. So a big kind of part of what I try to uncover in the book is how this works and what the ground rules are between these newspapers and the national security press and the CIA and other government agencies that they cover. And for example, everybody seems to acknowledge, although they're not proud of it, that they basically give the CIA and White House veto power over what they write. I mean, in order to be able to get the scoops that they want, reporters, generally speaking, have to play this game where they tell the CIA at least 24 hours ahead of time what their story's about and give the CIA a chance to, you know, supposedly in some cases protect their employees if they might be in danger by what's going to be reported. But, you know, it's usually a heads up that can lead to stories never being published, you know, for reasons that are against the interest of the American people, certainly, and also just completely fly in the face of the concept of what a free press is supposed to do. So the direct manipulation of paying reporters to be assets of the agency may no longer exist, but they don't need that when the newspapers and other media outlets volunteer to do this for them. You know, and it's very difficult, that said, for reporters, even those that play by the these rules that I'm describing, to actually know the truth of what they're reporting because they're in such a difficult position. So, Seymour Hersh has very, very good sources, obviously, and every once in a while he's able to write a story that will sort of puncture the myths that are being put out there and take everybody by surprise. And you mentioned that one story involving the chemical weapons that were used in Syria. I mean, that we could have... Who knows how things would have unfolded had President Obama used that intelligence to, you know, to as a justification for becoming militarily involved in Syria. But everybody in the mainstream press kind of ignored that story or has attacked Seymour Hersh and claimed that he didn't have evidence to back it up. But President Obama evidently didn't think that the evidence was there. Otherwise, he would have acted on it, supposedly, because that's that green line that he was describing. Another really important story that Seymour Hersh broke, of course, was about the Osama bin Laden raid. And this is something that, in talking to reporters and even former CIA officers, you know, who are familiar with the events and familiar with the constantly evolving official story that was put out there about how this was a result of very careful detective work by the CIA, that isn't apparently what happened. Seymour Hersh has very good sources that told him that, in fact, the CIA paid for this information that was given to them by a former Pakistani intelligence officer who claimed that effectively the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, had been holding bin Laden in a house, and this is where he is, and he wanted the money for it. And so it might have been a different story had that helicopter not crashed, because apparently the plan was for the CIA to take bin Laden across the border and claim that he'd been killed in some sort of skirmish in Afghanistan and thus sort of avoid any undue embarrassment for Pakistan. But once the helicopter crashed, Obama had to go make a different announcement, and they didn't have time to come up with a really coherent cover story. And so it just sort of kept changing. And so Bob Baer, who's a former CIA officer who I interviewed, told me that, you know, the story of how the SEALs went in there on their own and did this without the Pakistanis knowing about it is utter nonsense, and anybody with any familiarity about how the SEALs operate would know that, and that he talked to SEALs that agreed about that. So the full story hasn't come, you know, hasn't been made public yet, but Hersh seems to be on the right track. But, of course, what happens when Hersh publishes this story? What does the rest of the American news media do? It follows the same familiar Gary Webb kill the messenger script. They just attacked him, his personality, and didn't do anything to advance the story, although there are a couple of interesting exceptions. Carlotta Gall, one of the most experienced reporters in Pakistan for the New York Times, said that she had heard exactly the same story but just hadn't been able to prove it. And, of course, she works for a paper, the New York Times, that probably wouldn't have published that anyways.
Isn't this all actually a part of a psychological operation or PSYOPs? And you can speak on the CIA and the U.S. government's long-term goals and agenda for encouraging only its version of a reality they fabricate upon the population, including using Hollywood in the CIA-Hollywood relationship. Could you provide us with some insight, for example, the truth, at least as much as you know, about Zero Dark Thirty, the movie, because people believe it's an actual movie based upon the actual events, and they don't know how much input the CIA had.
The really interesting thing about that movie was that even before it came out, it was being subjected to some very unusual criticism by members of Congress. Senators Dianne Feinstein and John McCain both attacked the movie because it depicts torture scenes in the hunt for bin Laden, and they claimed that they had access to, you know, classified information showing that the torture didn't actually provide any intelligence for that operation, and that this was a big error that the filmmakers had made. And so the crazy thing about that is that, of course, as we all know now, the CIA was deeply involved with torturing people. Now, as Hirsch's story clarified, it doesn't appear that people were tortured in the course of providing information that led to his capture, assuming that we already knew where he was because we paid for that information. But that's just a sideshow, because what the film is really doing is telling a very pro-CIA tale, spinning a CIA myth to the effect that, you know, our, you know, daring agents through this incredible detective work, but also by virtue of this very expensive commitment we have to spy operations around the world, was able to track down this terrible, you know, terrorist mastermind. And so that's the story that most Americans believe is true. And to tell that story, the CIA deliberately picked the filmmakers that they thought would do the best job in telling it and get the movie done fastest and with the biggest budget. And they broke all their own rules of working with Hollywood up until that point by bringing the filmmaker and the director onto the CIA campus and meeting with all the key players in this operation that had supposedly happened. And this became quite a scandal. I interviewed reporters who covered this and uncovered what had happened. And the CIA now, just in the last week, is being called to task on this finally by Congress. They're going to not have the same ability to try to sell their story to Hollywood the same way that they've been doing in projects like that. But of course, Zero Dark Thirty is just one of the more outlandish versions of this. Argo is another example of where the CIA worked with Hollywood to put a completely false story out there involving the rescue of American hostages in Iran, which enabled both the CIA and Hollywood itself to come out as heroes in a rescue operation that was actually much different than the way it was depicted on film.
What was different?
Well, the Canadian Embassy played a major role in rescuing these hostages. Tony Mendez, the Ben Affleck character, the hero of the film, he was just a disguise maker. There was no outfit, this Mission Impossible style team of people that's depicted in the movie. So it was just it was a good story initially, a magazine article, but just got embellished in a film that I think is the most lucrative collaboration between Hollywood and the CIA's public affairs team that's ever happened, because it just drew in tons of filmgoers at its box office records almost unparalleled.
I'd like to once again turn your attention to the operations dealing with Hollywood. You've just mentioned one film, but they've been involved in many different films. And I know the Pentagon and the State Department has worked and collaborated with the film industry for decades, and this includes contractual agreements and financial exchanges. And I think a scholarly book was written about the CIA in Hollywood several years ago. Where else would Hollywood get tanks and military jeeps to blow up, you know, on the sets? And the Defense Department provides advisors to film directors and producers frequently.
Yeah, well, I mean, the CIA was working with Hollywood before it was even the CIA. During the Second World War, you know, all the propaganda movies that were being put out sort of established a template for trying to create patriotic and, in many cases, you know, admirably anti-fascist type propaganda movies during the war. But then this continued into the Cold War, and of course the message became much murkier. Films like Animal House, which had much more subtle political message to it, became like completely just anti-communist after CIA consultants sort of weighed in with the Hollywood studios. And so the CIA later admitted it had consultants in every major Hollywood studio whose job was to basically sort of monitor the political message of movies that were being made. And this continued all the way up until it was exposed again, along with the rest of Project Mockingbird in the 1970s. But so there was kind of a dark period there where the CIA didn't have the same ability to get its message out there. The Pentagon was never really subjected to these constraints because they were always able to make the argument that any, you know, propaganda efforts that the military is involved with are basically to try to protect U.S. troops. And so there's quite a different, very openly acknowledged history of Pentagon collaboration with Hollywood, providing, you know, naval ships, fighter jets and whatnot, all the hardware for these movies. But the CIA stayed out of that for a while. But then in the mid-1990s, they hired a psychological operations expert named Chase Brandon, who became sort of their chief liaison with Hollywood, and they started soliciting projects that would be favorable to the CIA. And so then there became kind of a revolving door of all these people working for the CIA that would leave and then become consultants for Hollywood projects. And so whether we're talking Homeland or Alias or 24 or really anything where Hollywood is trying to get some sort of realistic veneer to their scripts, they'll hire these consultants that that used to work for the CIA that will be paid to work on those projects. But the end result is that, you know, time and time again, these shows always churn out a reliably CIA favored narrative. And that's something that most people just don't have any idea exists, but I was actually able to interview a lot of these consultants about the work that they do for the first time.
Nick, about a year or so ago, I was watching a video clip sent by a very credible journalist friend of mine, and it showed a German journalist, highly respected German journalist, named Dr. Ulf Kott, K-O-T-T. And this was about honesty in reporting, and he criticized his own newspaper, and he had published in major European papers, and his own paper was a major European paper, and he said that there was strong association between intelligence agencies and fake news. He said you simply cannot believe what you're hearing reported because these are lies. And we're reporting on behalf of the CIA. Are you familiar with Ulf Kott's story? And could you go any further into these intelligence operations within the foreign media?
Yeah, I didn't interview him for my book because I didn't hear back from him or the publisher of the book that he wrote. But I'm familiar with his basic claim, and I did some digging. And it turns out that what he's describing is entirely accurate. It's very likely that he is just one of very many foreign reporters that was paid by the CIA to write, in his case, you know, reliably pro-NATO, anti-Russian stories, and fake or otherwise. I mean, the CIA doesn't deny that they continue to recruit foreign, you know, reporters and editors to try to seed stories that then will be picked up by the American news media. And so because it's been illegal for decades now, since the 1970s, for the CIA to, you know, directly pay journalists to write stories or to plant stories in the U.S. media, they can get around this by just simply having the stories be seeded in the foreign press, knowing full well that they'll be picked up by the American press. This is an old practice. Frank Snepp, who worked for the CIA in Vietnam, for example, he wrote articles for The Economist, he said. I mean, he didn't know that it was The Economist that he was writing them for, but he would write these articles, and then they would end up in the Economist under a different person's name. So Ulf Kott, it's quite possible, when he talks about fake stories, his name may have been attached to stories that were just written by the CIA and through some sort of arrangement were published under his byline. But this is a very standard, clever way for the CIA to get its stories in the U.S. press and get around the legal restrictions.
My final thought is concerning Hillary Clinton. We have seen, and it's been alleged or reported, that Hillary Clinton has had the media, the mainstream media, go very easy on her and not bring up her old different scandals and crises. But they have with Trump, and they have virtually ignored Bernie Sanders, and Jill Stein is simply invisible in this race, as is Gary Johnson. So when you look at Hillary Clinton and you look at how well embedded they are after their 8 years in Washington and then hers as senator, what role do you feel that the intelligence agencies have played, if any, in manipulating the kind of coverage she's gotten versus the other candidates?
I mean, I can't address that with any special insight, but one of the people that I spoke to for the book was Noam Chomsky, and I just asked him, you know, what insight he could give me into the intersection between the elite news media and the national security state. And he thought about it for a while because he said it's not really a topic that he's ever really dug into too deeply. But, you know, he's done quite a bit of work, of course, on the structure of the corporate media and what its interests are. And I think that when it comes to Hillary Clinton, she's both a product of and a symbol of corporate America. And the media outlets that are in a position to sort of challenge that or to dig deeper into her record are also just a reflection of you know, the corporate interests that govern this country. So it would not surprise any sort of intelligent observer of the way the American news media works and how it's evolved to see that, you know, that an agenda represented by a candidate with all these shady dealings in the past is going to be given relatively light treatment, and somebody who represents a complete threat to that, someone like Bernie Sanders, for example, who you can't really dig into and find any dirt in order to discredit him, the only other tactic there really is at that point is to just sort of ignore him. So that's exactly what happened.
Well, they did a good job on that.
Unfortunately.
Nick, thank you very much for all your good work, and especially your latest book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. We appreciate all your efforts.
Thanks for having me again. My pleasure.
And that is Nick's show. That's S-C-H-O-U. From Santa Ana, California. His websites are focusfeatures.com and ocweekly.com. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.